Before we get going, here's the bit where I remind you that nothing we discussed should be considered as investment advice. This conversation is for informational and hopefully entertainment purposes only. So while we hope you find it both informative and entertaining, please do your own research or speak to a financial advisor before putting a dime of your money into these crazy markets. And now, on with the show. Welcome, everybody, to another edition of Shifts Happen, featuring my co-host, the excellent Luke Gromann. Mate, how are you? What a pleasure to see you.
Yeah, I am doing great, Grant. Happy New Year to you. It's great to see you as well.
Happy New Year to you, my friend. You know, I've been wanting to have another one of these conversations for a while now because things seem to be happening so quickly and all over the place. But the trigger for this long overdue conversation was a couple of pieces that Zoltan Pozsar wrote from Credit Suisse last week, which really caught my eye. I know they caught your eye too. And look, first of all, I just want to say, you know, kudos to you because this piece that Zoltan put out about war and commodity encumbrance, I think was the first one back in kind of late December. And, you know, he was talking about the things that you've been talking about for, you know, 6-7 years now. And this was what first kind of brought me to your work, was finding out the sort of stuff that Zoltan's talking about and you were talking about a long time ago. And it connected so many dots in my head instantly. And from the time I read that first piece of yours, I've had this framework in the back of my mind. And I think once you have that, the dots are so much easier to join because you're looking at things the right way. And stories that are confusing to some people and irrelevant to others fit into that mosaic that you laid out. So let's begin at the beginning for people who are catching up to this, because I hope a lot more people are going to catch up to you and your work as we go forward. Let's talk about this, the very beginning, and step back and talk about what exactly we're talking about here.
In the end, what we're talking about here is, from a first principles basis, you cannot have an economy function when you have a finite, exhaustible or exhausted energy resource settled in a reserve asset that requires negative real rates just to avoid bankruptcy of that sovereign. And in plain English, what that means is you cannot sell oil just for dollars settled in treasuries if the treasuries consistently fall in price versus oil. It's the system simply cannot work. It breaks down. Yale Zylstra, the former head of the Bank of International Settlements, or BIS, in 1980 said, we got through the first oil crisis, we got through the second oil crisis. System cannot survive a third oil crisis because we will not be able to recycle the petrodollars back into the importing nations with any hope of repayment. He didn't say in real terms, but I think he meant in real terms. And the system breaks down. And his words, not mine. And so basically, that is the first principle is, okay, number one, the U.S. debt position. And I pick on the U.S. because the U.S. is a global reserve currency issuer. Treasuries in the post-1971 system have been the primary reserve asset. Debt and deficits of the United States have gotten so high that the U.S. cannot afford positive real interest rates. We need negative real interest rates, below the rate of inflation, and in particular, peak cheap energy. When you layer that on, you have to have treasury yields just de facto below the rate of increase in price annually of oil and gas, oil in particular. And if you have that, the system breaks down in two ways. Number one, you have the oil exporters going, this is a terrible deal for me. If anybody wants to take this deal, please let me know. I will happily borrow $1 billion, $10 billion. Warren, call me. That $125 billion in cash you have, I will borrow all of it at negative 2%. Just let me know, just relative to real rates. That would be great. And next year, I'll pay you back 98% of your money and we can do it again. And when you say it like that, you realize how stupid the whole thing is. You would have to be a massive idiot. And there are no idiots at the card table of that size in the world. So the oil exporters get disincented to grow production because they can't store their surpluses in their energy-related surpluses in something that preserves the value of the oil in the ground, they're better off keeping the oil in the ground. And so they don't keep it all in the ground, but they're certainly in no rush to take it out of the ground and produce it for something that's going to lose 2% a year, or as Vladimir Putin specifically said in June, 8% per year in the case of dollar and euro FX reserves. Why take it out of the ground? Leave it in the ground. So that then flips over to the other side of the global trade equation, the oil importers, both the creditors, China, Japan, India, Europe, at least used to be, and Germany in particular, and the energy importing debtors, the United States in particular. And where it shows up for them is energy inflation. So now you already have sort of this peak cheap energy problem, but now you're incenting with negative real rates, energy producers to slow steam, to stop producing, because it you can't sell for negative real rates, store your stuff. So you end up getting this sustained energy inflation feeding on itself, which you're probably going to have with peak cheap energy anyway. And now your bond market starts to break down, which puts upward pressure on yields, which then puts upward downward pressure on your economy, downward pressure on tax receipts, upward pressure on issuance. And you go into this debt doom loop that looks a lot like what we had last year, which is rates up, economy down, yields up in treasuries, in even in the slowdown we had in the second half of the year, and dollar up massively. And we wash, rinse, repeat until the system goes, you know, kaboom. And so from both sides, this first principle of the debt levels in the West at the sovereign level and peak cheap energy among the producers are combining to make it impossible to store the surpluses of an energy producer in negative real rate sovereign debt in any real way.
Yeah, and it's funny, you know, when you think about oil as a commodity first, and then you think of it as an asset, because I think we've all become used to thinking of oil as an income stream for the Middle East countries in particular. Let's talk about OPEC, right? It's been an income stream. And they dial the supply up and down depending on their needs, and also for the past 40, 50 years on the needs of the West. If they needed more oil, they would, generally speaking, comply and they would turn up supply. You know, we saw a notable deviation from that recently when they cut production. But if you stop thinking of oil as a means to an income stream, and you think about it as savings, if you think about the oil, that commodity, as their savings, then you instantly understand it from a completely different level, right? And what you said makes a lot more sense, right? You don't fritter away your savings. You keep it in the ground until, you know, you find a place to deploy it that makes financial sense. And just that simple kind of reframing of oil as savings rather than an income stream changes everything to me.
I think that's right. And that's when you think about it that way, you realize you need to, if you as an energy producer, you need to store surpluses in something that preserves the value, in a reserve asset that preserves your value in oil terms. It rises with oil. Right. Bonds can't do that anymore, not after the 40 years we just had, and gold can. And similarly, if you are on the energy importer side, the creditor group right there, the creditor group there, China in particular, Japan, Europe. Japan has been much more tied with the U.S. historically. Europe and China have spent the last, Europe last 50 plus years, and China certainly the last 10 or 15 years, trying to gain what I've written about and termed energy sovereignty, the ability to buy energy in their own currency. Because otherwise, this debt doom loop that I described earlier around the dollar takes them down, and it takes them down before it takes down the U.S. And so it is an utmost matter of national security for them to buy energy in their own currency. And practically speaking, the reserve asset that is that makes the most sense in a world where nobody really trusts each other is gold, and we've seen moves in that direction. Once you see it through that way of understanding oil, not just as the import, as the exporter's asset, but as the key linchpin of the balance of payments swings globally. It completely changes the picture of motivations, right? So for example, if you take away, if China in 2018, if China were to buy all of their commodities in yuan, their trade surplus would go up by $800 billion. They would never run out of dollars and they would have complete control over their balance of payments. They would never have a 97 Asian currency crisis. And they would have the ability to manage the yuan dollar cross rate through commodity import blend, how much we're doing in yuan, how much we're doing in dollars. Similarly, Jean-Claude Juncker in 2018, who's famous for saying things he probably shouldn't say, said the Eurozone is importing 300 billion euro a year in energy, and 98% of it is in dollars. This makes no sense. We are selling airplanes amongst ourselves made in Europe in dollars. This makes no sense. And here too, if you were to switch that 300 billion euro bill all over into euros, it frees up 300 billion euros in their balance of payment. So you have this ability in this world where we talk about dollar shortage, dollar shortage, dollar shortage, dollar liquidity is key. These countries can use, on the importing side, the importing creditors can use moving away from energy and dollars to manage their dollar liquidity in a way that is national security related, game changing, et cetera. And that, I think, is what I think a lot of people miss in this, is it's not some, oh, they're ditching the dollar. This is about a balance of payments, and that energy and commodities more broadly are the key swing factor to balance of payments around the world. And it's something Americans don't spend any time thinking about, because we just print money for all of it anyway. And we have since 1971.
Right. No, exactly right. And we've reached that point now where we're in that every man for himself kind of world now, right? And everyone's got their own problems to deal with. And these are real solutions to parts of those problems. But it's interesting, you know, you bring up Juncker and you bring up heads of state. And Zoltan said something in his piece that I thought was really interesting right at the beginning. I'm going to quote from him here. I've got it somewhere on my notepad. Here we go. Here we go. He said, in a moment when the world is going from unipolar to multipolar, the actions of heads of state are far more important than the acts of central banks. That's because heads of state lead, their actions affect inflation, and central banks merely follow by hiking rates to clean up. And that really, really struck me, because it's something you and I have spoken about for some time. And it's interesting, when picking through your work and putting various presentation things together myself, you suddenly realize that the people you're quoting are heads of states. When you talk about this, when you talk about this new dynamic being unveiled, we'll come on to the central bank digital currency aspect of it shortly, because that's important too. But that's really an outcome of the framework. It's not necessarily the driving force of it, right? It's what you need to be able to create these outcomes. So let's talk about the heads of state. Let's talk about the changes that are happening at that level, and forget the central banks for a moment. So walk us through what you're seeing in terms of new alliances being drawn up and why those are important.
Yeah, so I'm trying to think of how far back to take. I mean, you can go back to, you know, Zylstra, when I quoted him in 1980, right, at the head of the BIS. He was a part of the Dutch contingency showing up demanding gold back from Volcker, right, before Volcker was Fed chair in the early 70s, right? So he goes from head of state to BIS. And at the BIS, he's talking about this fundamental balance of payments problem around energy. And in the early 70s, he was addressing that balance of payments, which was not just energy, it was Vietnam War and Great Society. And he was addressing it by saying, give us our effing gold. Give us our gold. We want our gold back. And Volcker was trying to convince him, hey, don't, you know, you're rocking the boat, stop. And okay. So I bring that up by way of saying you can go back 50 years. You can see declassified conversations between Kissinger and Enders and another U.S. policymaker, where they're talking about a move led by the French in the mid-70s to begin settling European energy deficits with the Arabs in gold at a floating price above the official price. And you have Kissinger say, well, that's just a balance of payments issue. There's both sides of the Atlantic. It was understood it's a balance of payments issue around energy. You go forward into the creation of the euro. You and I have talked about this before. Putting gold in, 15% of Eurozone reserves, mark to market. Obviously, the Iraq situation, moving to pricing their oil in euro. We know what happened there. We've seen Putin, really, I would say, that brings us, I would say, to Putin, who has, I think, in the last 10 to 15 years, been the standard bearer for this move. He's been the dealer, right? He's the guy who has the oil and the gas and the commodities, and he understands it, you know, whether he wrote it or not. He probably read it, but he has a PhD paper you can find online by Vladimir Putin about energy economics and balance of payments. And so he has been, and by the way, he published that in 08. That was in 08. So for the last 10, 15 years, he's been sort of the dealer, the guy with the oil, the guy with the commodities, the guy with the understanding, and importantly, the guy with the nukes, because the United States has never attacked anybody with nukes, not overtly or directly. And he has been facilitating over the last 8 to 10 years this move of, hey, China, I'll sell you oil and gas in yuan. Hey, Europe, let's do the Nord Stream 2 pipeline. And we can do those deals in Europe. We can do Nord Stream 1. And if you've not been following what Putin says, you've been missing a big part of the picture, to Zoltan's point. I mean, he gave this speech in June. He gave another off-the-cuff press conference at the Shanghai Cooperation Organization in September, where he stood up for 35 minutes and just answered questions. And whether you like the guy or don't like the guy, you can very clearly see a difference in his ability to freelance questions versus most Western leaders. And he lays it out, particularly the June 2022 speech, in which he says, look, we cannot sell oil for foreign reserves, FX reserves, whose value fall in price or 8% per year in dollars and in euros, and kind of lays this whole thing out. So on the other side, you can go over to China and you can go, you know, there, it's a little bit, I don't know that any central bank is truly independent, certainly not anymore. But you can go back to 2009, when the head of the PBOC talked about the need for a neutral reserve asset akin to what was also proposed by Keynes after World War II. You can go back to late 2009 when I believe he was a Pulitzer Prize winning reporter, Robert Fisk. He passed last year or the year before, but with the UK Independent, right? So this is not, you know, this is not the National Enquirer, this or Russia Today or whatever. This is a UK Independent. It's a decent paper. And, he points out that in 2009, he had been told different sources there were high level meetings at the state level between major European nations, major Arab Gulf nations, China, about moving energy pricing from the dollar to settling in gold. I mean, this is 14 years ago now. So you can see these sort of breadcrumbs. I think in our conversations before, Grant, I've likened it to sort of seeing a glass-walled conference room, right? You can see who's in there. You can see the mouths are moving, but you can't hear what they're saying. But every so often, someone goes out to go to the bathroom and the door swings open and you hear the conversation for 10 seconds. And that's what we've been seeing all along. And if you've not been paying attention, if you don't know the history, if you don't understand the balance of payments swing, energy is the balance of payment swing factor, full stop. There's other stuff around the side. Semiconductors have gotten very, very important, which separate discussion is why all of a sudden we care so much about Taiwan and China's interest in it.
Yep.
But oil historically has been the swing factor. It's why Kissinger tied the dollar to it in 73. It's the swing factor. So if you know the history, if you know the balance of payments factor, and then if you just sort of listen when that door swings open, you can sort of start to, you know, feel out what seems to be the elephant in the room, and, you know, and you're hoping you're grabbing the trunk and not something else, but you can start to see these things.
You know, what's really interesting in this is that people coming to see this now, and it's getting harder and harder. I won't say to ignore, but it's coming harder and harder to not see this stuff happening in clear view. Now, you may not be able to put the puzzle together. You may not be able to kind of figure out what it means going forward, but it's impossible to deny now that certain actors are becoming much closer, much more tied together in terms of what they need. And it's very difficult to not see the natural fits between a lot of these people. But again, what we're talking about here is a fundamental upending of the entire global financial system. And people think that takes time. And of course it does, right? And this is something that I find fascinating, is the people that are coming to this now and are being forced by Xi Jinping's visit to Saudi recently and the speeches of Putin. They're being forced to see this now. But in your mind, you think, well, okay, fair enough, but this is going to take a long time. These things don't happen overnight. So which is why I wanted you to go back, because what people don't understand is this stuff has been in motion for decades now. And
oh yeah, we're 50 years in. Yeah.
We're 50 years in. So we're actually, what we're actually doing is reaching the point where it starts to speed up. All the stuff, the frameworks that have been put in place are there, and they start flicking switches and turning stuff on. So let's talk about Xi's visit to Saudi, because I think that was important for a number of reasons. And the speeches he made and the very overt way in which I think he finally showed the hand that these guys have been putting together. And the fact that he did that, to me, says, you can't stop this now. We're happy to tell you out front what we're doing and make more people aware of it, because this thing's going to happen and it's in play and it's going to happen quicker than you think. So talk to me, as you looked at Xi Jinping's visit, what you thought and how you think that has changed things.
I think your analysis is exactly right, which is, this is so far along now. This is a boulder rolling downhill. You're not going to stop it. I hear credible rumblings from the Chinese side. I hear credible rumblings that it is just a question of what percentage they're going to do in yuan. And people say, well, oh, the Saudis are never going to sell at all in yuan. Probably true. But again, there's this fundamental misapprehension amongst most people that are coming to this or looking at this a certain way, which is, in commodities, the marginal ton prices the whole, right? So the marginal barrel of oil prices all of it. We know that. We can look back to April 2020, when oil went to negative 37 a barrel, right? That wasn't because it was all worth negative 37. It's because there's no home for the marginal barrel. Same thing here. China can price the marginal barrel. It doesn't need 50% of Saudi oil in yuan. It needs 5%, 10%. And then it can use that to manage. China's goal here is not to displace the dollar. They don't want to be the dollar of 1971 to 2021. They want a system that has a bank core at the center of it. They want a neutral reserve asset. And they want the reason they want that is they know they are screwed if oil stays priced in dollars, if they have no ability to manage their balance of payments around commodities, around oil. Because remember, that is the whole lever. Take away that, they can manage the yuan dollar cross rate through their commodity imports instead of through burning down finite reserves or through raising rates. It breaks the trilemma. And this is so poorly understood. The trilemma of energy holds for these emerging markets as long as they can't price energy in their own currency. Once they can, that's the Democles, you know, that cuts the Gordian knot of the trilemma. Okay. So on China's side, it's just a matter of okay, what percentage? I hear credible rumblings from the Saudi side. It's more complicated. Saudis are dancing on the head of a pin, because they're getting 30% of their oil demand is being taken by the Chinese, by far and away their biggest client. The Saudis also have apparently a lot of LNG that they are looking to export. They potentially looking to export into global markets. China could take a lot of it and would be happy to take a lot of it and would be happy to invest in Saudi, in China, bring the Saudis on as partners. So it's a really big win-win. Now, the Saudis also have a very big historical relationship with the U.S. The Saudis also understand the realpolitik of let's just say how that game can be played. The Saudis still have defense needs that the U.S. largely provides. And on the flip side, the Saudis, were horrified by what the U.S. did to Russian FX reserves. Right. Horrified. Right. So they are more coy about like, hey, this is done. That, but if you take a step back from that, I think it is such a watermark, such a, you know, just a huge signpost of this is happening. It's going to happen. It has to happen because the system break, you know, Yale Zylstra, the system will break down if you don't do it. And so I think it was a really, I agree with you. It was a really big moment on that front.
Well, it's funny because the Saudis, to your point, are literally and figuratively right in the middle of this, right? They're geographically in between the two. And they're in between the two in a metaphorical sense, given what's happening, as you point out. But you can look at what they say and you can look at what they do. And they're very careful in what they say. But having the very first China-Arab state summit in history held this year and having very clear photo ops and all kinds of staged opportunities with Xi Jinping, their actions with their treasury reserves into divesting themselves of those, there are clear examples here of what they're actually doing, never mind what they're saying. And I think this cooperation between the Gulf states and Xi, and when we bring in the Belt and Road, which people kind of have looked at and talked about for, you know, best part of a decade now. And at first it was just this curiosity and, oh, here's what China's going to do. And then it just kind of went away. They poured money in everywhere. And then it just kind of became passe and people stopped kind of focusing on it. And again, this is one of those things that once you think of the Belt and Road in terms of what we're talking about here, it becomes something completely different. It's not just China looking to do this and that and own port infrastructure. And it becomes a way to tie all these countries back to a new currency system that allows countries in that part of the world that are dependent on each other for trade and all kinds of other things to transact without involving the U.S., right?
Yeah, I think the Belt and Road is, you know, Zoltan has been repeating this phrase all year. This, it's our commodity and it's your problem.
Yeah.
And what the Belt and Road helps address is this fundamental tension that ties back to what I was talking about before, which is, is the dollar primal or are commodities primal? And 2022 showed without a doubt, oil is primal over the dollar. Given the choice of having a dollar and having oil, from a use standpoint, this what is happening is breaking. You know, for a long time, oil equaled dollar. They were fungible. The fungibility of those two are breaking down. And the Belt and Road provides the use case, right? Hey, invest with us. Invest in this system. There's enough infrastructure work there. I don't even know how, you know, but it's decades. And that entices not just the people literally. I mean, the Belt and Road stretches the whole continent of Eurasia. But it's interesting to, you know, from the base level of, hey, let's bring electricity to places and water to places, sort of basic infrastructure to places that have never really had in a major way, all the way to Germany, where you already have those things, but people like Siemens and you know, these infrastructure providers would have a book of business for decades supplying this. So there is a, you know, sort of this productive use case of improving lives, improving standards of living, deploying commodities into improving standards of living in a virtuous cycle. On one hand, and this is, you know, Zoltan does a good job of highlighting it, versus this trying to keep this existing system going, which amounts to basically the Fed weaponizing the dollar and trying to keep past surpluses sort of money good against commodities over time. And the longer it goes on, the more obvious, all else equal, the value proposition of the former is versus the latter.
I think, you know, another way I've looked at this and thought about it is, you know, we've had, give or take, 40 years of declining interest rates. And when you've had rates going down, down and down and down, getting to zero and staying there for an extended period of time, then the most important commodity in the world is money, right? And whoever's got the most money controls things. And when you can print money at will, like the US can, it makes that more important. But if rates are going higher and we are back to a world of rising rates for however long, you know, suddenly having that money is not the most important thing. Having the things that you need to buy with it to protect yourself becomes preeminent. And so you're right. That's why this whole framework of it being commodities being so important has been kind of revealed by the power shortages, thanks to Russia and the Nord Stream. Suddenly people realize that at the moment, it feels like most people have just connected the dot between energy rather than commodities, right? And I understand that a lot of people view oil almost not as a commodity. Oil is a separate standalone thing all of its own. But exactly the same dynamics apply to copper and zinc and lead. And as Zoltan pointed out, EV battery metals, where Widodo in Indonesia is talking about an OPEC-type cartel for lithium and other EV metals. You know, and there's a clear coming together and a recognition that the tables are turned here, and having the ability to create money is no longer the most important thing. And having the resources is, you know, almost overnight much more important. And it's no surprise that countries that have been subservient to the people who are able to print money are suddenly realize, hey, you know what, we hold the cards here and we need to press this hard and we need to press it fast, because I don't know how long that advantage is going to last, right? I mean, that seems to me the way a lot of these mines are working, and that suggests that this will happen much faster because they have no idea how long this window stays open for.
Yeah, and I think it's, you know, a book I started reading over the holiday. I'm not quite done with it yet, but by it's Disorder, Chaos in the 21st Century by Helen Thompson, who's a professor of political economy at, I think, Cambridge.
Yeah, there's a great interview with her, our mutual friend Dimitri Kofinas did recently that I would urge people to listen to on Hidden Force. It was fantastic. Sorry, carry on.
And yeah, so she made the point, you know, in the first half of the book that the message China took from the U.S.'s willingness to basically destroy itself on the rocks of Iraq back in the second Iraq war was, holy cow, there's a resource issue. And so the Chinese, this was 02, 03, 04, 05. I tie this back to the Belt and Road. I tie this back to Zoltan's point on this commodity encumbrance and who has the leverage, because he makes this point of, hey, commodities are going to become increasingly encumbered. Commodities have already been encumbered for 10 to 15 years, and the West doesn't realize it yet. And that's going to be, I think, one of the big surprises in 23, 24, and 25, which is to say, Helen Thompson highlights, the Chinese took from our actions a sense of desperation around energy supplies. Like, what, they couldn't believe the Americans were being that stupid. They didn't think it was stupidity. They think the Americans knew something about resources and the need to control them in the Middle East. And China adjusted their actions accordingly. What I mean by that, you can go to 2013. There's an article on Reuters, how China took control of an OPEC country's oil. And in 2013, China had already struck deals with Ecuador such that China was going to have access to 80% plus of all of Ecuador's oil produced from 2013 through 2020. Now, what did they do? They lent them dollars and they took oil in return. Well, why would they do that? They need the dollars. Well, look at all the refining capacity China's bought. Guess what China can do? China can take the oil, refine the oil, break it down, make the spread, sell in dollars, sell in yuan, then China makes themselves a dealer in the same way that Russia has made themselves a dealer in this capacity. And you can see this done over and over and over and over. China has basically done two things with this. Number one, they've already encumbered a lot of the commodities. I know I've sent to you before, I did a chart. If you look at the world's top 15 oil net exporters in 2012, right? So net exports is a critical concept because it's not just what they export, it's what they produce minus what they consume domestically. Net exports, what's available. That's what sets the price in the market. Okay. So in based on the 2012 numbers, back in 16 and 2018, I went through this top 15. China had already struck deals, development deals, investments, swap lines, outright yuan pricing. In a few cases, like Nigeria, they had made the yuan a secondary reserve currency. The point is that by 2016 or 2018, China had already done deals with countries who represented 90% plus of oil, global oil net exports. The market's already encumbered. The market's already encumbered. And nobody understands this yet, virtually nobody. So when Zoltan's talking about it, it kind of ties back to your point before. People are saying, oh, okay, now I have to pay attention to this. Like, the game's already over. The Chinese realized it in 02 or 03 based on what the Americans did in Iraq. Like, wait, why are they going there?
Right.
Oh, there's a resource issue. Quick, swap dollars. And they spent the next 20 years swapping dollars for energy supplies. Now, that's a very dangerous world because now all that's left to do is fight over it. Economic warfare, hopefully not warfare. Certainly Zoltan refers to that too. But there's this encumbrance standpoint that once again, it's, oh, well, I guess I have to think about this now. It's too late. It's over. That ship sailed 10 years ago. So now, and that's, I think things are going to accelerate very, very meaningfully as a result of that.
Well, let's come back to Xi's speech, because some of the things he said in there are very important. You know, he talked about the next 3 to 5 years, that these ties between China and the GCC countries were going to get much, much stronger, right? And he laid out the roadmap. He talked about the priority areas. He talked about, I think he called it a new paradigm of energy cooperation. And interestingly, he made reference to the Shanghai Petroleum and Nat Gas Exchange and how it would be, in his words, fully utilized for settlement in the trading of oil and gas. And that's really, really important, right? That's a huge change. And I come back to the Shanghai Gold Exchange. You know, I want to fold gold into this conversation now because I think it's the right time to do it and people will start to understand the slightly bigger picture here. When the Shanghai Gold Exchange launched back in, what was it, 15, 16, probably 2016, somewhere like that?
2014. The international board launched in 14.
14, yeah.
But not domestically longer than that. But.
Yeah. And, you know, you and I talked about that. I did a presentation with some of the stuff in it at that time, pointing out that this was a game changer. And, of course, as usual, and I fully expected it to happen, people went, well, look at the volumes. It's a nothing burger. It doesn't matter. And it didn't. It absolutely didn't, right? But it established guardrails that allowed certain things to happen. And the fact that the volume wasn't huge didn't matter. And it was probably a good thing for the people who set it up that it wasn't big volume because it enabled them to kind of smooth things out and make sure it worked. And obviously once it works, the volumes are immaterial. You can really start passing anything through that. So talk to a little bit about the nexus now of the Shanghai Petroleum and Natural Gas Exchange and what they're looking to do there, and the Shanghai Gold Exchange and what they're able to do there, and talk a little bit about how those two fit together and how that changes things.
Yeah, I get a lot of pushback and always have. Well, China doesn't have an open capital account, so it doesn't matter.
Yep.
And one of the least understood points of what China has done is China opened their capital account 2014 with the opening of the Shanghai Gold Exchange International Board on a very limited basis. It was through gold.
Right.
You could take offshore yuan and you could go to Shanghai, the international board, and buy gold. And yes, the volumes are small, et cetera, but the volume there is just a function of gold's price. And to me, it was extremely elegant because the West, and certain elements in the West, in the US and UK, want China to fully open their capital account because then capital can rush in, can rush out. And they can tip over China very easily with just, hey, rush the capital in, rush the capital out, and okay, great. Financial warfare like we've seen run by the West for decades. By doing this, it was much more measured by China. And it was elegant because it means that to attack China's capital account in a financial warfare, you first need to buy gold, which means you need to attack the dollar first. So, you need to drain, you know, ultimately, if you're draining China of gold because of the structure of that system, which is the Shanghai International Board is related to but not connected to the domestic market, the domestic gold never doesn't come out. You don't take China's gold. What happens is you start buying gold to sell, you know, to open up China's capital account and you drain London, you drain New York. So that... it was elegant in that it opened it in a limited way to prevent an attack. But number two, it added credibility to the Russias of the world, who almost immediately started selling gas in yuan to the Chinese. It opened credibility. And you can see that this was the entire goal. I've said all along, the Shanghai Gold Exchange International Board, it's not about gold. I think gold will benefit over time. I think it has benefited over time. I think it's going to benefit a lot more. It's not about gold. It's about oil. It's about energy. And it's about Chinese energy sovereignty, full stop. And so you can see that when in 2015 at a presentation at the at an LBMA conference, at a London Bullion Market Association conference, Yu Yongding from the People's Bank of China said, we want to internationalize yuan. Gold is going to help us internationalize yuan. And the mark of an internationalized currency is the ability to invoice oil and gas in that currency. This is 2015. They just flat out told you what they're going to do. Now, Shanghai Energy Exchange was a little bit of the same thing. But there, too, when you look at the flows, it opened China's capital account through oil. If you buy oil in yuan and you make money in yuan, you can change the currency. You can pull it out in dollars. That's an open capital account through oil, through gold, which is, I say, elegant for the same reasons. You got to run up oil if you want to attack the Chinese capital account. So I think it's really critical from both a measured way of opening up the capital account to prevent an attack. I think it's really designed to gain credibility for China to buy energy in yuan as a means of national security. That's all it is, in my view. Gold, I think, will continue to benefit tremendously, but it's about energy national security, energy sovereignty, as the reason they did that.
But as you said earlier on, you know, if we're looking for a new reserve asset, it's pretty clear that that's important for the world now, particularly, as you say, in the light of the freezing of the Russian central bank assets, a new neutral settlement asset is really important so that political power can't dominate money flows, right, and be used as a weapon. And that's a natural thing for gold to become. So it's very interesting that alongside all this news, you know, late last year, we had the PBOC announce that they bought more gold, which they haven't done for a while. They haven't announced it anyway. And then we get the headlines at the end of the year that this was the biggest year in 55 for central banks gold purchases. And a lot of people just take this as an anecdotal piece of evidence, and it could be. But when you wrap it into what we're talking about here, and you wrap it into much higher strategic geopolitical moves, it seems clear to me that there is an understanding that at some point, gold is going to be forced back in, even if it's just in the short term to stabilize things, but gold is going to be forced back in as some kind of reserve asset to neutralize things on both sides. Am I reading that right? Or is there another explanation to that?
No, I think that's right. I think the other context to that too is this third quarter of 22 saw the biggest quarter of central bank buying of gold in history. It was like 400 tons, I think, in the quarter. 300 right. tons or 400 tons. And the context that's always left out that I think is important is that was the single strongest quarter of dollar performance, I think, ever. So the dollar is just ripping. And central banks who, in theory, you know, if you ask, you know, 100 people on Wall Street, hey, the dollar's ripping, what are central banks going to do? They're like, oh, they're selling gold. They bought gold at the fastest pace ever. So I think there's something there that is noteworthy, particularly when you layer it in with, you know, the Europeans not renewing the central bank gold agreement in 2019 and different things that happened in 2020, different things going back in history. I think it's significant. I think there is a recognition of this, particularly when you layered in with something you talked about before that Zoltan talked about, which is this, you know, the central bank digital currency pipes. Another pushback I've always gotten as you talk to people is, well, they're dollar pipes. So at the end of the day, it's dollar plumbing. And yeah, I see the relationship you're setting up, but it still has to run through dollar pipes, so it doesn't matter. And here we have one of the most foremost experts in plumbing in the world, Zoltan Pozsar. In this piece last week, the first one, which to me, and I saw the MCBDC paper as it went by, someone put it in front of me, I skimmed it, shame on me. But people say, oh, it'll take years, decades to get the pipes to replace the dollar. Or 6 months, 12 months. Like the pipes are there. And you have Xi, you know, to your prior point, Xi referencing this BIS, these BIS central bank digital currency pipes to MBS, to the Gulf nations, not just MBS, all the Gulf nations
Yeah.
And so you have the settlement asset, you have the you have the situation that we talked about before, peak cheap energy, Western sovereign debt, you have the settlement asset, you have the actions by central banks, and sort of the last missing, you have the Chinese opening up the capital account, you have the Russians playing along, you have others starting to play along, and now you have the pipes. The pipes were the last thing. And if the BIS is going to facilitate extra dollar system settlement of these energy flows netted out in gold, like you're ready to go. Like, to your point before, this isn't decades from now. This is like, they've already tested the MCBDC. They were doing volumes through UAE late last year, I think hundreds of millions of dollars. So, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars, who cares? Yeah, true, who cares? The oil business, though, is $2 trillion a year, $2, $3 trillion a year. So, like, you know, $2 trillion, 5% is $100 billion, right? So, you're half a percent. That's who cares so far. But it's digital. You ramp it up, and now all of a sudden, it's all there. It's all there way faster than anybody thinks. So as I read his pieces, there was a lot of stuff that was pretty familiar to me. I'm like, yep, that makes sense. Yep. So I didn't think about it that way. That's brilliant. Oh my gosh. When I got to the sort of the CBDC side, it's like, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
This is why she is so boldly talking about it. This is why Putin is going to war when no one thought he would. This is why, and I think possibly this is why he keeps raising the nuke thing. Is like, I think that he is facilitating a currency system transition. And I think that is signaling on his part, like, I will go to the mattresses on this. Do not go, because it's ready. If the BIS has the pipes and the BIS manages the pipes, so it's not the US, it's, BIS, it's central bank or central bank. This thing's ready to go, I think.
Yeah, I mean, that MCBDC project, the bridge or whatever it's called, it's China, it's the UAE, it's the Bank of Thailand, and it's the HKMA, I think. There may be some more. It's definitely those guys. So you've got the UAE, right? You've got them there. You've got the Chinese, the biggest borrower in the world. You've got Thailand as a kind of representative Asian central bank. And you've got the Hong Kong.
You've got a gold exchange project, in Dubai.
Right? You've got a gold exchange in Dubai. Right? And so, when you look at this, and people talk about, it'll be a small amount, but you have to remember every dollar counts twice, right? It's one less dollar of demand, but it's also another dollar that has to be found to finance the US at a time where its finances are more fragile than ever. That's a point that people don't seem to think about. Every billion dollars is $2 billion.
It's something I've referenced for a long time. Zoltan references it in the paper. He's pretty direct. He's like, listen, if you think this isn't going to impact the dollar and treasury markets, you're crazy, right? Basically, exactly. Is what he says. And I have a chart I've used in presentations. You and I've talked about it before, Grant, where I show, China. This is as of 2018, so the number's smaller now. But it actually proves the point, right? In 2018, I put up a chart. I said, here's China's, FX reserves as a percent of GDP. And China holds 25% of their GDP in FX reserves. Here's the same chart for the United States. And the United States holds 0.6% of GDP in FX reserves. Why? Because the Americans can print money for oil, for commodities, for anything. And the Chinese can't. And so they have to have the dollar supplies just in case. As they gain the ability to buy energy and commodities in their own currency, facilitated by all this other stuff we talked about, that 25% should come down over time. And that has helped. Last 4 years, Chinese reserves have not moved and the economy has grown. So it's absolutely huge, because then the flip side of that is exactly your point, which is at that same time, U.S. deficit has gone from 2% of GDP to an incredible 7-8% of GDP at the economic peak, which is a staggering number. Debt has gone from 95% to 125%. And then maybe the most important number that speaks to the acuteness of the issue, starting in 2016, I started tracking what I called the big three expenditures of the U.S. government. It was entitlement paygos, treasury spending, and defense spending. It was basically, I said, this is the stuff they can't cut. And in 2016, right before the Fed started raising rates, I noted, hey, this is like 67% of tax receipts. Okay, whatever. And I ran it out. I was like, okay, once it gets over 100%, it'll be a problem, but that won't happen until like 2020 or 2021. And it happened in second quarter 18, much faster than people thought. And where it is now is, you know, at the peak after COVID, it was 140%.
Right.
So
it
doubled in 5 years as a percent of receipts. And the most important thing is they have to print the difference, right? So now, not only does the same dollar count twice, it takes it away from the demand, it increases the supply, but it increases the supply at a time where you're already in a desperate situation. I mean, it is, so it almost like, it almost counts twice and then you square it almost in terms of the,
yeah.
Now, does that mean the dollar crashes? Well, no, that depends. What it means is if the Fed doesn't print the difference, the dollar goes to the freaking moon and treasury yields start going up, which is exactly what we saw last year.
Yeah, no, it's exactly right. And again, this point, does it happen? Does it mean dollar crash? No. And people, I think, have become conditioned to think in absolutes. It's either carries on or it crashes. And that's not the case. We're seeing it happen slowly, but it's the Hemingway, right? It's the slowly and all the one things. There will come a tipping point where it accelerates and it could turn into a crash? Absolutely. But I've pulled up the quotes from Zoltan here that you said, and I want to read them because anyone that hasn't seen this article, he says very clearly, he says, don't tell me that, i.e. everything we've talked about, doesn't threaten the dollar supremacy or that it won't hurt the exorbitant privilege. And he underlines that in red, and then he underlines this in red. The US dollar and treasury securities will likely be dealing with issues they've never had to deal with before. Less demand, not more. More competition, not less. De-dollarization is about to accelerate from here. And that's, you know, that's underlined in red. So it's a very clear message. And importantly, you know, I come back to some of the stuff Ben Hunt talks about with common knowledge, you know, this is the sort of thing that once Zoltan starts saying things like this, it becomes something that more people are aware of, right? Because Zoltan's reach, rightly or wrongly, I have my opinions on that, is greater than yours with this. He has greater reach. So more people are now putting these dots together. And if the number of times I've been tagged in Zoltan's piece on Twitter is anything to go by, and I'm sure you have as well, there are an awful lot of people who are suddenly reading this from a guy who everybody will tell you have to pay attention to.
Yeah, it's not Grant the Gold guy and that crazy ball guy in Cleveland.
Right,
anymore.
Right, exactly. It's not us. It's not us. And that's fine. I'm perfectly happy with that.
Absolutely.
But people are now having to think about this. And this whole situation, and again, I want to give you kudos for being such a brilliant, brilliant observer and chronicler of this as it happened in real time. No one's done a better job, and I mean no one has done a better job of this up until now than you have. If you are forced to think about this, if you are forced to pay attention to what's happening and you have this stuff laid out the way Zoltan has, it's very difficult to find a way that you don't have to at least think about taking some action. Because you are now having to try and insulate yourself against a whole load of issues that you've never had to before and that are diametrically opposed to every problem you've had to face so far.
You know, it's interesting, the common knowledge and Zoltan's point, right, of the treasury market's going to have problems, right? There's this great chart that you've seen in my work, and I've highlighted it multiple times, and it's all credit to Michael Guyad, who put the chart together. But it goes back in time, and it looks in top 20 drawdowns for the S&P 500 going back 70 years. Never has the treasury market, has the 10-year treasury sold off more than equities. People say, oh, it's just inflation. In the 70s,
yeah,
in the big drawdowns of equities, the treasury market did not draw down more than equities. In 2022, they did. And so when you say this common knowledge game, when you say this recognition, and it's going to force people, at some point, I think in the first half of this year, especially if/as Zoltan keeps harping on this, as he says he's going to, people are going to realize, holy shit, it already started happening. The treasury market acted the way it did because of this. Like, this is already underway. And as I interact with people on Wall Street, across Wall Street, across the world, I would divide them broadly into two camps. And like in 2016, when you and I started talking, you know, camp one was like you, me, and like four other guys, right?
Yeah. All of them just as weird as us. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah. And that camp, the numbers have grown rapidly, particularly post 2020 after we had the treasury market crash. Really after the repo rate spike at the end of 19, and then right. and then the treasury crash at the height of the COVID pandemic. And, you know, I would paraphrase that group as once you see it, you can't unsee it. And so I get things like, holy shit, like all through 2022. Oh my gosh, look, TLT is bidless. And I would take the other group and I would qualify them as sort of like,
Right.
Like, you know, and it's fine. It's what makes markets. But there's this view after 40 years of, hey, yields go down. High levels of debt means yields go down. Look at Japan. And the problem is they're using the wrong model. Is Japan is a positive net international investment position, means they have a giant piggy bank they can sell. They're running current account surpluses. They're running trade surpluses. It's a the defense provided for by the U.S. So they're an entirely different animal. Everybody else has found themselves in this position. And now actually Japan's finding themselves in this position too, by the way. Yes, high levels of debt drive yields down up to a point. And once right. you cross some threshold that the solvency of the government itself is called into question, where it becomes mathematically obvious that the government cannot pay its bills without money printing, which is what I just said with the big three being still 120% of tax receipts at the absolute peak of the cycle with an all-time record tax receipt bubble, we're at that point. It's mathematically impossible for the U.S. to pay its bills without the Fed printing the bond, which is fine. Again, doesn't mean the dollar's going to crash. If the Fed right. doesn't print, it means the dollar spikes. However, everything we're talking about with the oil, with the energy, gold, this sort of, you know, what Zoltan is writing about is bringing that point forward, right? So if the tipping point was at 110%, this just brings it down as it takes the debt up. Just by virtue of us having to finance more of our own deficits. And there's no balance sheet. There's not enough balance sheet to finance U.S. deficits in the U.S. and globally in the private sector. And central banks aren't buying it because of everything we just discussed.
Right,
central
right.
bank holdings of treasuries haven't risen in 8 years. So there's this, as we go from sort of the second group going like, you know, it's a bit of an exaggeration, of course, right? And I don't want to hurt anybody's feeling, but there is an element of that. I guess there's a little bit of bitterness out there, some of the guff I've had to take over the years from some of these people. But as the recognition grows of like, oh, wow, you know, because I think the treasury market's going to keep trading like crap. And this year will be really interesting, right? Because I do think the inflation, you know, we saw it in the second half of the year. Inflation data rolled over. They're rolling over hard. If the treasury market doesn't respond, to me, that's the catalyst for people yes. going, wait a second. Okay.
Yeah. Why aren't yields going down? Exactly. Yeah.
And you can already see it in the real yields versus gold, right? Like that's jaws. And like everybody, there's a lot of people saying, well, I'm short gold because they're going to close. Like maybe, but those jaws are exactly what you'd expect if what we're describing is gaining traction.
Yeah, and I think you know, it's interesting when you talk about the guys with their fingers in their ears saying, la, 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 they don't want to listen to it. They've been right not to listen to it because it hasn't mattered, right? And so it's absolutely sure. fine. You don't need to listen yep. to it, and you can poo-poo it all you like. It's totally fine. And the evidence wasn't in your face showing you what was happening. It was kind of in the weeds, and it was only guys like you that were digging around trying to find it. But a lot of those la-la-la guys are smart guys who have chips on the table and a vested interest in protecting them or growing them. And it comes back to this point of this common knowledge. Once this starts happening like this, you have to take your fingers out your ears and say, okay, right, what was everybody been saying these last? I need to catch up quick. I need to catch up fast. And I went down to Australia in 2005. I moved down there. And when I got down there, I was talking to guys down there about subprime and saying, look, there's, you know, you don't have to understand subprime, and this is happening in the US, and this is going to be a big problem. And the standard response was, Ash, you'll be right, mate. Don't worry about it. It's Australia. It's all good. And no one wanted to know. And it was absolutely fine. But it was very interesting to watch when subprime became the front page story in Australia, how many kind of my mates and colleagues would sidle over to me and go, mate, Do you want to go out for a beer? And you go out for a beer and they go, just run me through that whole subprime thing again, would you? I need to understand what it's all about. And it was fascinating. But that's how this stuff happens, right? It's you don't have to get it immediately because it doesn't matter until it matters. But when it starts to matter, which is everything that Zoltan's written suggests is now, you have to get up the curve fast or you get run over.
And I think that's right, because it didn't matter 14, 15, 16. I think it mattered a little, but not really. It started to really matter, I think, in 18, you know, that late 18 when we had that, yep. You know, hey, we're going to raise rates. And then all of a sudden the market has its worst quarter since 08, right, in the fourth quarter. And it was like, oh, well, we're not going to raise rates. And then you had the repo rate spike. And then you had, you know, the treasury market crash. And then you had sort of these symptoms of this. But there was enough other stuff going on that you credibly and plausibly say, well, yeah, that probably factored into it. It was more this. Or yeah, that factored into it, but it was more that. And to your point, I think this is where we're going to go. You know, the only thing keeping the treasury market and tax receipts high enough, and therefore the treasury market, remember, real problem is inflation.
Right.
Like the Fed is furiously sawing at the branch that both it and treasury are sitting on. And they're going to saw it off. And I think it's going to fall off here in the first quarter. And I think it's going to be really interesting because that's the moment, to your point, I think, and one of, if not the moments, where you go, okay, we're having this binary downshift in the economy. Commercial real estate's getting marked to market. VCs are blowing up. Housing's blowing up. Unemployment has gone from like here to here, like it always does. And why is the 10-year at 4 and going higher?
Yeah.
I don't understand. And that's going to be where, like, with guys like Zoltan highlighting this, like, it's what I've referred to as Voldemort, right? It's the U.S. balance of payments crisis, right? It's a thing you can't talk about. It's the name which, or yeah. the villain which must not be named. It's a balance of payments problem. And it's clear as day that there is not the global balance sheet there in a recession to finance U.S. deficits today, let alone what deficits are going to do in the slowdown that I think we're going to see with inflation coming down. And that'll be the moment, I think, where people really go, okay, this is a balance of payments problem in the reserve currency issuer of the world. That means everybody has a balance of payments problem. Now what? And right. Holy cow, the risk-free asset is risky. What does that mean for? And yeah. That is a, you know, that's quite the rabbit hole to go down. But I think that's going to be the moment. I think that's probably going to come in the first half of the year where we get this, okay, deflation's here. Where are my bond gains? And TL, you know, the yield on the 10-year is going to go, and they're going to go, wait a second.
Yeah.
That's different.
Yeah. Mate, listen, we're going to keep chronicling this, you and I, because it's such a fascinating story. And I'm so keen to have as many people understand this as possible. And as I said, you are by far the best guy to walk them through this. So we'll keep having these conversations. There's so much more we could talk about, but it's going to keep unraveling and unfolding. So I want to make sure that we just keep doing these periodically as and when things happen. So look, my thanks to you. For anyone listening to this who isn't following your work, and again, please, please, please follow Luke's work. Luke, tell them how they can do that.
Sure. And thank you. You go to our website, fftt-llc.com, for information about our institutional and mass market research products. And you can follow me on Twitter at Luke Groman, LukeGroMen.
Yeah, it's not too late to follow Luke on Twitter. You will one day be able to say I was one of the first million to follow him. So get in early. Mate, listen, my very best to you and the family for New Year's. Take care of yourself and let's do this again soon.
Likewise, have a great new year, and I look forward to chatting with you soon, my friend.
Thanks, mate. Bye-bye. Nothing we discussed should be considered as investment advice. This conversation is for informational and hopefully entertainment purposes only. So while we hope you find it both informative and entertaining, please do your own research or speak to a financial advisor before putting a dime of your money into these crazy markets.